Welcome again to Andy and Leon Missing the Point, Episode 6. Without any sort of script, Andy Graham and Leon Daniels wander across nostalgia, remembering favorite TV shows, movies, and personalities. This episode is recorded surrounded by Spitfires at Biggin Hill with guest star Paul Campbell. This episode also on YouTube.
Right, okay, well, here we are with episode 6, I think it is, following on from our trip to Dad's Army Museum. We've decided to come to the, in fact, we've been invited to come to the Biggin Hill Heritage Centre by my good friend Paul, who I've known for many years from Le Mans and various things, but has always been very hospitable in minding my questions when we've come and asked about Spitfires, and indeed has often allowed us to sit in one.
Is that
we
right?
Might be able to do later on.
So is this the one in five people who are happy to answer your questions as opposed to the four out of five?
Exactly, yes. So.
Well, it's good, isn't it? So we're down here in Biggin Hill, which is absolutely tremendous. It's a glorious day. We've already seen a Spitfire take off.
Yep.
And if we listen very hard, we might see it come back. And since we were last on our travels, we were at Thetford in episode 5 for the Dad's Army Museum. A couple of things have happened since then.
Indeed.
So Simon Baldwin died, so the architect of the Vulcan 607 Port Stanley raid.
Yep. Tankers.
11 Victors.
Yes.
My goodness me.
All calculated on a cheap pocket calculator.
Yes.
None of your interactive things involved.
And Judith Chalmers died.
That's true.
We've lost one or two. Roger Cook.
Indeed.
Investigative journalist. Again, people from our past. So, condolences to everybody.
Okay, what Paul's actually got somewhere is a piece of the Victor from Black Buck. So, is that one of your things that you queued up to get in an air show like that, bit of a Spitfire that you once did?
No, I made a nuisance of myself when they were scrapping the aeroplane at Manston.
Yeah.
And in the end they went, do you want a bit? I went, oh, that bit, please. And they cut through bundles and bundles of wire, undid a couple of bolts, gave me this heavy piece of instrument panel.
Oh, wow.
It's still stenciled on the back of it, XL511, and that's the Victor, getting nerdy. The Victor that finally hooked up with 607 and saved
it.
My piece is from the Victor that refueled that Victor to get to that rendezvous.
So, Paul, why don't you tell us what happens here?
What happens here?
Because I'm new.
Well, it's kind of the world centre of Spitfire activity. And it's nice that it's happened here, because Biggin Hill was synonymous with the Battle of Britain and the Spitfire, although they served everywhere, but this seems to be the place people know because of the name. And from the Battle of Britain, the history of the place, but it's not a museum, it's a restoration centre, and it's where we do the passenger flights from. So you can come here and fly in a Spitfire and go to the Dover, Beachy Head, fly around Kent.
Yeah.
And it's a complete accident. There was never a master plan to do this here. It's kind of a side effect of one guy's obsession with Spitfires and having his own Spitfire and basing it at Biggin because it's his nearest airfield, and then getting a second Spitfire restored, having problems with the people restoring it, and then taking it off them, selling it, and then the person who bought it from him saying, where can we get it restored?
Oh, right.
And he saw an opportunity and said, right, I'll sort that out. From one Spitfire, it was going to be a one-off gig. From one Spitfire restoration, we've now done about 16... Ooh, there's 17, 18, 19 in the works.
So where we've just walked through, there's people on a Sunday afternoon fixing bits of Spitfires, riveting, getting the spars all sorted out. We've been showing all the details.
On a Sunday as well.
Sunday.
Yes, that's dedication.
And or overtime.
And you walk outside and you can actually, as you say, get in a spit and fly. And your family can go in a Cessna alongside.
Yeah.
And then in the place where we're sitting, I can see 1, 2, 3, 4 Spitfires, 1 at Messerschmitt 109, 1 Hawker Hurricane, 1 Curtis Walker.
Another Spitfire there.
Oh, there's this one snuck in. Plus a load of...
At least two more over the back
there. At
least two
over the jack. A couple of Mustangs next door. And then we've also got Steve McQueen's Jeep and a load of other stuff that's not really aeroplanes. But if you're going to have a hangar full of men cave stuff, why not? Oh, and of course the Yamaha FS1E moped.
Oh, without which no historical facilities would be complete.
Yes, indeed.
But if you can, please count the Spitfires here, because I don't have a clue.
No. What is the collective name for Spitfires? Squadron, I suppose.
Biggin Hill Heritage Hangar.
Yep.
We've recently gone through a change where we're now called the Spitfire Company Biggin Hill.
Okay.
because it's kind of misleading. It makes us seem like a museum, and we're not. It's a working hangar.
No,
that you can visit.
Yes.
So there's an important distinction to
that. Yeah.
So where do people go to get information if they want to talk to you about either having a visit or having their Spitfire installed?
If you go to flyerspitfire.com, everything you need is there.
That's the one. That's good. That's the one.
It does exactly what it says on the aluminium.
Exactly that.
And some of the Spitfires here have been in movies that listeners will have.
Yes, we've got aeroplanes here from the Battle of Britain film. We've got one from... It was set dressing in the background in Reach for the Sky. Well, that's one we've restored here. That's now gone back to the Dunkirk. There's always something going on. Yeah. You have to delve back in the history of
Israel. Well, I think we should mention Battle of Britain as a movie because...
That's why we're all here.
That's what we saw. We saw Michael Caine saying, "She's going to overheat if I don't take off soon," and all those various phrases. We've all got our favourite line from Battle of Britain, like we do from Great Escape and Push Too Far.
And is that the film you wanted to see twice?
I saw it twice in Woking Cinema in, I think it'd be 1969 when it came out, wasn't it? Something like that.
Sure. My sister Crystal, you didn't just see it twice, you stayed in the cinema.
I stayed in the same cinema seat and watched it all over again.
Did you have to pay twice for that?
I don't know.
No, you could just stay in there.
They put the next film on, didn't they? Had Kia Ora in the break, and away we went.
In the intermission.
Yeah, Crusader Nuts, yes.
Indeed.
And then, of course, we all had the Music for Pleasure, Jeff Love LP that we got from Woolworths for 49p with the theme tune on, which, of course, there were several themes in the movie. There was the original Sir William Walton posh classical music bit, which is at the end. And then I believe Ron Goodwin was taken on and did the Luftwaffe march at the start, which I was very pleased to see my daughter play in the air training corps band in front of the King and the Prime Minister in Guildford many years ago. It was very good.
And Jeff Love, whose son Adrian Love became a DJ for Capital Radio.
Indeed.
I tell you what,
if you've got one of those albums, Paul, you need to hang on to it because I've tried to get one and they are as rare as hen's teeth.
I have got one, but mind, all the years I've had it, when you play the Great Escape theme, it skips.
Oh no! Jumps over the wire.
It's got a critical skip in it, and when I watch the film, I can hear the skip. It ruins the film.
And when we talk about Spitfires, one of my favourite sort of really sad bits of Anoraki knowledge is: do you know what the last aeroplane to shoot down a Spitfire was?
Go on.
It was a Spitfire. In the
accident.
No, it was in the war between Egypt and Israel of 1940 something. Two Spitfires were involved in combat, and one shot the other down.
Do you know where it is?
Do you know where
it went down? We'll go and get it.
I'm going to say it's either in Egypt or Israel, something that way.
Okay.
But somebody asked me that once, and I'd had to check it out because I thought it would be like a right at the end of the war. It'd be a Fokker Wolf 190 shoots down a low one, but no, it had carried on after the war. And indeed, the RAF fought against, I'm going to say, the Egyptian Air Force with Spitfire on Spitfire, but whether they actually shot down, I'm not sure. What's that noise we can hear in the background, Paul?
Sounds like a Spitfire, doesn't it?
It sounds like a Merlin.
Yeah, it could well be. It's not unknown around here. Let's have a look. It could be the Mustang that went outside, but it doesn't sound like a Mustang, does it?
No.
That's a strange thing. So, same engine, different sound.
Why is that then?
Different exhaust.
Different exhaust.
Yeah.
Different.
Yeah. Well, if you've got a trained ear, you can tell. But
a trained ear?
Trained, not a deer.
Oh, a trained ear. Okay,
you can tell the difference between a spit hurricane.
I thought trained deer was some sort of hearing aid. Right.
And Paul, you were telling us earlier how you tell the difference between the different sorts of Merlin engines.
By listening or the manufacturers?
I was thinking of the thing underneath.
Oh yeah, no, there's a lot of Merlins were built by Packard in America. And I joke with visitors that the Packard is the Rolls-Royce of Merlins because it doesn't leak oil like a Rolls-Royce Merlin does.
But so the Rolls-Royce one built in Derby, they were being bombed and...
Exactly, you could build Merlins in the States without being...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Without going down the shelters in the middle
exactly,
of working.
Exactly, and going home and having rationing and worrying about your loved ones, whereas in America they could just get on and... manufacturing.
Yeah, and plus Packards were damn good cars. So,
exactly. Yeah.
I think the tolerances were finer.
Yeah.
And they had the luxury of over-engineering it a bit more. You can see bigger bolts holding the casings together. And things
okay.
Like that.
So,
you can tell the difference between a Packard and a Rolls Royce by the size of the drip tray under the brake.
The size of the puddle under it. Yeah.
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 Oh, there we go.
Amazing.
So we've done the Spitfires, but there are other aeroplanes here. You've got a couple of Mustangs. You can go for a flight in a Mustang, I'm told.
You can, yes. We can do Mustang flight. Similar price to the Spitfire. I think it's a little bit less, actually.
Oh, okay.
But our Mustang, Moonbeam McSwine, it's silver and blue. It's gorgeous.
It's an absolutely gorgeous aeroplane.
It's gorgeous. It's like a... Not a mirror finish,
no.
An appropriately shiny finish,
yeah,
but it's it's the classic looking Mustang.
And the Mustang has got a big double seat because you've got a big bubble cap.
It's got a big cockpit.
Yeah, big cockpit.
Like all American aeroplanes, the cockpit is huge.
Yes.
And there's ample room for a seat in there without altering the fuselage.
Your Spitfires are all converted into training ones, and one of which is the prototype for
that's
me.
Right, yeah. We've got the only surviving Spitfire prototype in the world here, and it's a Mark 8 Spitfire. Converted to two-seater in 1946.
And those Spitfire trainers were used by the Irish, weren't they, and people like that?
They were used by the Irish, the Netherlands Air Force, the Indian Air Force, not many other people. They only made 20 of them.
Yeah.
Because it was a way of trying to sell off old Spitfires.
Sure.
And the jets were coming in. It wasn't a seller.
So if I get this right, the nearest thing I've ever seen to this, I think, before, is what happens with Mark 1 Ford Cortinas, right? Frankly, there are people building every part of a Mark 1 Ford Cortina. There's an infinite number of spares.
Yeah.
You could build a new one if you really wanted to, but most people don't. They just find an old one somehow, somewhere, and get all the bits that they need. And that's what's happening with Spitfires, right?
You could
fashion anything.
You could build new wings and a new fuselage and put them together, but that would be a replica.
Sure.
So we try and stay on the right side of... You want like 30% at least. And critical parts like the firewall that carries the identity of the aeroplane. Mm. Even in service, engines would change, tailplanes would change, wings would change.
Trigger's broom, I think, is the
yeah,
place.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but that core of the aeroplane...
The firewall itself is the
firewall, yeah. Frame 5, we call it. Everything seems to meet at that point. And if you own a frame 5 and you know the identity of it, you own that Spitfire.
You were showing us on the walk round that you've got a number of airframes here that have been around for a long time, and that the magnesium rivets effectively just dissolve in air.
Mm.
And so one of the first things that you do is replace thousands and thousands of rivets?
In a wing, there's 86,264 rivets.
Do you count them all
plus
out?
Or minus 25?
Oh, OK, I was going to say, because otherwise...
They vary.
You've got one, you see.
Yeah.
And there's this lovely story, isn't there, about their flush rivets, but during the war they wondered whether it was worth making flush rivets, so they...
Yeah.
Well, you can tell
the prototype was entirely flush, which means the rivets don't protrude above the skin into the airflow. But of course, that's time consuming. So if you can use some dome headed rivets, it's quicker to produce.
Yeah.
And they took the prototype and they got a bag of split peas, stuck them on the rivet positions, flew it, tested the performance data, removed some, flew it again, reached a happy medium point for it. You know, it didn't make a difference if you left some dome-headed rivets on. So that would have made for more efficient production. These later ones, the Mark 9s, they're all flush riveted. But they needed to build them fast, so they needed to work out a balance of performance versus time to build.
So, like many stories in the war, but something really weird like a bag of split peas could have helped.
Cutting edge of technology comes down to, let's go to the co-op and buy a bag of split peas.
Exactly. Yeah. A bit like we mentioned a couple of episodes ago, Tilly Schilling.
We did.
And her thing in the carburetor.
A famous orifice.
Indeed.
I mentioned that there's a pub in Farnborough, the Wetherspoons in Farnborough, is called the Tilly Schilling. So those of you who are going to Farnborough Air Show, which will have happened by the time we record this, but never mind, there's Wetherspoons for you. So yet again, another story about ingenuity involving split peas, rubber rings, and how we won the war.
Yeah, I think it was a washer.
Yeah,
it's kind of a restrictor to stop all the fuel migrating.
It was a fuel flow when it was banking
hole.
I think if you're chasing a 109, he just noses over because he can, because he's got fuel injection. If you try and follow him, I think it's the case you get too much fuel.
Yeah, right.
It's a rich cut, and your engine stutters, and he's getting away.
Mm. Yes.
So they'd have to roll over and pull to maintain positive gravity. And now your belly to him, you can't see him.
Yeah.
The problem with 109s is, top tip in case you ever need to know this, there's always a pair of them.
Really?
So if you're trying to say in a hurricane, you're out-turning this 109 up your backside, you may well be able to out-turn him and end up behind him, but his mate, a mile away, is watching this happening. So yeah, watch out. There's never one 109.
Right. So that was a tactic. That was a
well. The Germans had good tactics. You see, they could. They were flexible. Then.
So this Spitfire we're next to here has got quite a big sort of bubble canopy. That's a later one.
It's the same kind of period as your Mark 9s.
Yeah.
So like 43, 44, 45. But it's got a cut down rear fuselage for better visibility with a bubble canopy.
Oh, okay.
Like Mustangs and things like that, 109s. 190s. Much
you
better
can see back in the back.
The problem in a Spit is you can't see behind you very well because of the armour plate and the fuselage, so you've got a mirror.
Yeah.
Which they didn't give them mirrors in the early days, they had to get their own using car mirrors.
Well, go to the Halfords.
They were taking them off cars, sticking them on because, yeah, you can't crane your neck round to see them.
No.
And it's the one behind you that you never see that's going to get you. So.
And so, Paul, what was the Achilles heel on the Spitfire?
Range, I think. It's the defensive fighter, so you've only got a radius of operation quite close to home.
Sure. And you also said that a lot of undercarriage failures as well.
A lot of these aeroplanes are a handful on the ground. Not as much as a 109. They lost lots of those in landing accidents.
Really?
Because it's a narrow undercarriage. And the wheels splay because they have to fit in the wings, which point sort of upwards if you look at it from the front. No, there's not many. I tell you what, the Spitfire is bloody good, basically. It's so well designed, built to last, not expected to last. A good innings was 3 weeks for a Spitfire. Yeah. But you look at one now, it doesn't look old fashioned inside, looks modern. The quality, everything's anodized. Yeah.
You were saying it's quite hard sometimes to maintain them because they were never designed to be maintained because they would have been shot down by now.
I don't know if difficult to make. Access to things
access.
Can be a problem.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at the engine cowlings on a 109, you flip a couple of catches, they hinge down.
Yeah.
On a Spit, you have to use a Zeus fastener release, like a big screwdriver, and you have to pop them all off.
Yeah.
Putting the cowlings on and off a Spitfire takes ages.
Yeah.
If you want to find the source of an oil leak or something like that.
Well, wasn't that where the Mustang came in? Because it has a much bigger range. Because a Mustang and it's like a Merlin with a fuel tank, isn't it?
The Mustang's a modern aeroplane compared to it's another generation on.
Yeah.
So you got Spitfires came out the same time as the Hurricane.
Yeah.
About 7 months apart, first flight.
Yeah.
But the Hurricane was the end of biplane technology.
Yeah.
Spitfire was the very beginning of.
Yeah.
Modern aeroplane construction. The Mustang's another generation on again.
Well, you've seen the model Spitfire that my dad made when he was an RAF apprentice in 1937, so it would have been literally only a few months after it taken into the air, and you were given a lump of metal and told to make a model Spitfire out of it and then send it home to mum to show what you'd done in the RAF. And that's my pleasure, one of my most prized possessions, and you've kindly put it in a Spitfire and flown it around.
Okay.
So my dad's
did we fly it?
You did.
Oh wow!
My dad's model Spitfire has been around in a Spitfire.
There can't be many of those that actually did that.
No, and he got it chrome plated many years ago, so I do have the old tin of Brasso and a bit of a clean now again.
Yeah.
There's many model aeroplanes that you get in junk shops and things that are made out of typically molten down gun cartridges.
Hmm.
But my dad's was a product when you're an RAF apprentice too. You know, it'd be a bit like making a model of a drone today.
Yeah. And so it would have been brass originally.
I think it was brass, and you had to hand file the lump of metal that it is the base of it, and you cast it in brass from a sort of sand mould.
I wonder if the Germans were doing the same thing.
Well, who knows? Anyway, we should put a little picture of that in the.
We can do that, can't we?
Pictures,
we can
yes.
do that. I shall rely on you for that.
Yes.
That would be really good. Well, it's an amazing place. It really is. And so, I mean, you welcome visitors, but it's a factory, therefore, it's not a museum, therefore, visitors are welcome by appointment.
Yeah, it's all pre-booked. I mean, we do have people just turn up, and sometimes it's someone with a connection with one of the aeroplanes, or they're here from Australia.
Yeah.
And they're going home tomorrow, and we do our best to work them
in.
You know, I had a guy turned up Christmas Eve. and he said, have you got... the Spitfires all have serial numbers, letters and numbers. He said, have you got BR601 here? I went, yeah, why is that? He went, my dad flew it 8 times.
Cool.
I went, well, come on in. You know, and he had his dad's logbook and pictures of his dad. And there was... BR601 was sitting over there. A lot of these aeroplanes they're not owned by us.
No.
Restored for clients.
Yeah.
And you can't let people sit in other people's aeroplanes. Well, I said they would have no problem with you sitting in this aeroplane.
No.
So we stuck him in it, and there he was sitting in his dad's spit, holding a picture of his dad sitting in the spit.
Oh, good.
You know.
Didn't get better than that, does it?
How there was a dry eye in the house, I don't know.
I think there was lots of grit in
there. Yeah, and that, I mean, you used to get veterans.
Yeah.
We still get a few, but yeah. Of course they're all 100 plus now, years of age, and now we're getting the family.
Family. You were saying about the air transport auxiliary lady pilots who would deliver Spitfires, and a couple of them had flown over 1,000 Spitfires to deliver them, I think.
Oh yeah, not just Spitfires. They fly 5 or 6 different types in
Lancaster
a day.
Bombers.
They had a little flip book with the basic numbers. Yeah. So that's what you need to fly airplanes. You need to remember a few different numbers. You know?
Yeah.
And they go right, Dakota. Okay, flip, flip, flip.
Yeah.
Off they go.
Well, there was a story. One of them, I think, it was Mary Ellis, who would always run out of fuel in the evening and have to land at an American Air Force base.
That was Joy.
Joy
Lofthouse. She said, like you just said, if ever I was low on fuel, I'd lob into an American base because they had better food, better fellas.
Yes.
You could buy stuff from the base exchange. And I said to her, I bet you had a bloody good war. And with that glint in her eye, she went, oh, yes. But she was a looker as well. You're going to get killed tomorrow. You might as well enjoy yourself today.
Exactly.
You know, but Mary Ellis said another thing, even more interesting. She said she was flying a Spit one day, and a strange-looking aeroplane pulled up alongside her. And she was looking at it going, it's got black crosses on it. It was a 109.
Yeah.
It just slid in beside her, seeing who she was, you know, because he wouldn't have had squadron markings.
No,
if it hasn't got squadron markings, it's probably just come out of the factory.
Yeah.
He could see this little lady flying it. And she said, I didn't know what to do. I was terrified. So I went, shoo, shoo. And he waved and buggered off.
Oh, chivalry. Yeah. Chivalry.
Oh, God, the stories you hear from these people. And I've written them all down. I don't forget them.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, because you're only going to get them from the horse's mouth once.
Well, didn't you queue up to get a bit of a Spitfire signed by Wellham and all those?
Wellham, Nigel Rose, Tom Neal, a whole load of people. Bob Doe, about the Brit pilots.
Oh, yeah. So Geoffrey Wellham wrote
that.
And
I gave it to your lot.
You did, and we sold it. So one of the things we should say is that Paul has been very supportive of, when we go to Le Mans, we have an annual general meeting where we auction stuff for my favourite charity, Mission Motorsport, whose Jaguar we showed off yesterday, thanks to Leon. And people, when they've had slightly too much French lager, will pay quite a lot of money for things that have anything to do with Spitfire.
Yeah.
So I think that was one of the most generous donations we ever had, was a bit of a Spitfire that was signed by Geoffrey Wellham, of course, wrote the book
First Light,
which, if you have not read First Light by Geoffrey Wellham, is also made into a BBC film.
Yeah, very good BBC.
Very much about how you would actually say things. The language used wasn't, what's the word I'm after, cleaned up for the audience.
Wasn't sanitised.
It's exactly how you would say if there was a Messerschmitt behind you, if you know what I mean.
I remember when I got that piece signed, because they're sitting at a table with pens, so that you're there to have stuff signed. And I put this mangled piece of Spitfire in front of Tom Neal and went, I hope you don't mind signing that. And he went, what am I supposed to do with it then?
Oh, they've got made that in the Nordic.
But I did say to them, I said, okay, yeah, this obviously is shot down Spit this is from, but the guy got out of this one. I'm not asking you to sign something that one of your colleagues got killed.
No.
And I said, Werner Mulder shot this one down. And they were like, I remember that name.
Was he an ace?
Oh, yeah. Well, we've got the Ace of Aces 109 over there.
Yeah.
Or do we not talk about that aeroplane? I don't know.
Can we talk about pictures? So, as well as Spitfires, you have two 109s in this hangar?
We've got a 109, and we've got the Spanish-built version of a 109.
Which, those of you who have seen the Battle of Britain film will have seen many of them, because they actually have a Merlin engine on board,
don't they? Yeah.
And they had to be dubbed, so they didn't sound like Spitfires.
Did they bother?
Oh, and I'm told they did, because they didn't sound different enough from Spitfires that you couldn't tell when they were...
I don't remember that being a detail. There's a brilliant paperback book by Leonard Mosley, I think is the guy's name, and it's about the making of the film.
Yeah.
If you can track that down, it's very good.
Well, I went to... Because obviously with Leon's Brooklands Association, but I'm a member there as well, I went to a lecture about the filming of the Battle of Britain and about how they had camera planes and all this kind of stuff. Mm. But there was one thing where they weren't allowed to bring a Heinkel 111 over London because it would cause
trauma
for people.
Yeah.
But they flew it over the Docklands and managed to get away with it, but that was the only time they'd flown over London. But everything else was, nice, was in Spain or something like that. Yeah.
Where is Dover?
Well, Polish chit chat and that's all that it, good
yeah.
stuff.
Oh, yeah. We had that.
Yes,
we had that here.
Have you had some Poles?
We had a guy. He was. I don't remember what he was flying. He was bringing a Spitfire in for a friend of his because one of our clients and friends owned a Spit, and he was based in the Czech Republic. But he got a Polish guy to fly over here for him, and it was the first time a Pole had flown a Spitfire back into Biggin. And it was back in the days when the Polish Air Force used to take convicts back to Poland.
Yeah.
And they had, he said, I spoke to the Polish Air Force on the way, and we had a private Polish chit chat. So it's still going on. Thank it's you. Still echoing to
yes,
this day.
It still echoes.
Yeah. Extraordinary. The media actually portrays many more Polish pilots than there were. I mean, I seem to remember there were something like 145 of them, but they flew so intensively.
They were the most successful.
They were the most successful. Yeah.
They outscored everybody as a group. I think that's right. And they are only allowed to participate towards the end of the Battle of Britain. But they were driven by pure revenge.
Yes. Yeah.
They had nothing to go home for.
Yeah.
As far as they knew.
Yes.
And you know, from their point of view, I'm going to take as many Germans with me as I can.
Yes.
And it was revenge. You can't fight that.
No.
Yeah, they ram you.
Yes. There's a memorial to the Polish airmen at Northolt, isn't there, at the end of the runway. Hmm. It was worth a tip of your hat to. At some point, we ought to mention, I suppose, Douglas Bader.
Well, yeah, you can't avoid him.
No. I caught the end of his This Is Your Life on YouTube the other day, and he did come across as a bit curmudgeonly, but then I guess if you were that old and you're still finding mobility maybe a bit difficult.
Yeah,
but,
he had a lot to be curmudgeonly about.
Curmudgeonly about, yeah.
According to my father, who met Bader at school prize giving, my father's uncle, apparently called Paddy Clare, based at Hawkinge,
yeah,
the Battle of Britain. And he went up to Bader afterwards, during the prize giving,
yeah,
and said, oh, my uncle was Paddy Clare. And he said, come and see me after. And they never let him go and see him. But apparently it was when he was at Hawkinge, that was his Batman.
Oh, wow.
My dad's uncle.
God.
That's what my dad said. Yes. You know, never managed to find any more than that about it.
But no. But he went on to work for BP or something after the war.
Shell,
something like that. Yeah.
Oh yeah, he was flying around all over.
And I still believe there's still a foundation that he set up to get disabled people
That's
to
right.
fly.
Yeah,
which I think is rather splendid.
Yeah.
Who else should we mention when we've got Spitfires on the mind?
Bob Stanford wrote the book about his Fly for Your Life.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and he flew from here, and he and a Spitfire that we've. A Mark I Spitfire that was shot down defending this place in late 1940. Him and Bob Tuck and Tony Bartley, who went on to marry Deborah Carr, they were coming back from Dunkirk.
Deborah Carr was an actress
That's
who was
right.
in...
Films. And they come back from Dunkirk. They had 139 holes in this Spitfire, and Bob Tuck come up alongside him and said, what you got there, old boy? A bit of lace. See daylight through it. And they had a bet, whoever's got the most holes, loser buys the beers. And they went down the White Hart and braced them. And that aeroplane's flying now. It used to be up on the wall as a display, the wreckage. And it's now in the Netherlands.
Okay.
Yeah.
The White Hart and Braced is a very fine pub, still there. Still has a flagpole in the garden where apparently you would fly around the flag when you were approaching to Biggin Hill. And they have a blackboard there that was signed by many pilots that's behind a bit of glass so that nobody can wreck it.
The original's not there anymore. No. No, there's not much history left. They've kind of taken it. We've got some bits on the wall from there.
Yeah.
I think the blackout... screen is at Shoreham Museum.
Could be, yeah. Yes, it's a shame, isn't it, that many of these things will disappear over time unless we actually make sure that they're put somewhere. But me, you must have these challenges with your buses.
Same thing. What's happening there? Diesel engineering is a dying skill itself. Things like the ULEZ increasingly means you can't use the vehicles in many of the places where they would be at home. Over time, there's the effect of the legislation and so on. So broadly, it's a skills, materials, and permissions. We wrote quite a lot of heritage stuff into the legislation, so there's like a rolling 40 years for old vehicles, which means, you know, you don't need MOT if there's no road tax.
Yeah.
Don't your buses get pressed into service when there's a bus strike sometimes?
We used to do a lot when there was an underground strike.
Oh, that's it.
We used to do a load of it for underground strikes. At my choice, actually, because whilst it's a mere pinprick on the numbers of people able to move, the buses can only do so much. But actually what it did visually was to show that we were doing something.
Yeah.
So when they saw all these beautiful old buses carrying people, there was a bit of wartime spirit about that.
Because and that was for free, wasn't it? You could jump on for free.
But it was very symbolic that we were seen to be doing something.
That's like the milkman with the milk stepping over the rubble in the
bit. Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Like, we're going to carry on.
It's exactly that. Just totally that. Yes, and things just carried on normally, for sure.
No. Well, at the cart marking show that we went to yesterday...
Cart marking yesterday by the Worshipful Company of Carmen, held every year at the Guildhall. It's the second biggest event in the City of London. Self-evidently, the Lord Mayor's show is the biggest. It's got a few things going for it. It's free. You can just come and go anytime you like. It's in the Guildhall Yard from 10 o'clock until 12:30. If you pay, there's a rather nice lunch. That top sandwich for 600
lunch.
People, it was rather good
lunch. Splendid
lunch,
yeah.
Perhaps the smallest piece of duck I've ever seen in humanity, but never mind.
Yes, yes.
But for people like you and me, that's probably all right. 51 vehicles marked. So the history of this is that way back in medieval times, if you were applying for hire with your cart in the City of London, you had to pay a fine in order to do so. It's like ULEZ, but hundreds of years ago.
5 shillings, I believe.
Yes, indeed. And in order to prove you paid, a hot poker with a particular symbol on it was pressed into the wood of your cart, and that proved that you paid. And so the Carmen, which is now one of the City Livery Companies, the Carmen is a sort of cross between the traffic commissioner, the trade union, the restrictive practices team, and the regulator. So what we do now, and I use the we because I'm the immediate past pastor of the Worshipful Company of Carmen, so I legitimately can use the we.
Yeah.
Is we recreate that every year, so you can come and have your cart branded, even if your cart is a hydrogen-powered truck, even if it's a motorbike, even if it is
an Oshkosh heavy equipment transporter that's capable of moving 118 tonnes that came along. But we also brought the F-Type Jag from Mission Motorsport, which has got a wrap, which is Winston Churchill's VE Day. Now, because it's not a vehicle for hire or reward, we couldn't actually brand it, but it was shown off anyway, and lots of people asked about all that money that we raise in Le Mans drinking beer that's used to fund basically a team of people who can now wrap cars.
Yeah. So I drove the press demonstrator F-Type round the perimeter track here in sport mode, with my foot buried so deep in the carpet, I don't think it ever came back.
there's a pattern in the
that's
carpet.
What, that's what happens to press demonstrators. Yes.
But you had a horse-drawn Cherubang.
Yep. And our 1890s horse bus, which we just restored at London Bus Museum.
Yeah, that's splendid.
Which was there, absolutely beautiful. And as we said yesterday, all painted in very bright colours because the population was illiterate and they couldn't read the destination signs, so they were able to recognise the colours. And so also with the adverts and so on, and of course a union flag mounted on a pole on the offside corner, which they all had, which by the way made it too tall to go through the arch at the Guildhall, so we had to remember to take it down when we went through, and our 1954 Army AEC Militant six-wheel breakdown recovery truck, which was built for the Army, as I say, in 1954 as a general purpose truck. It didn't get used much, so sold to London Transport, who fitted it with a 10-ton crane and was the master breakdown tender billeted at Camberwell Garage until it finished in the early 1980s. It didn't do much mileage there, of course, because the buses didn't break down very often. It was rescued by a wonderful guy, Andy Lambert, who drove it yesterday in the parade, which was tremendous. It came on a low loader, not because it's unreliable, but it's flat out at 34.
Yeah.
So broadly, if you wanted it at the Guildhall from Brooklyn, if you wanted it at the Guildhall by 10 o'clock on Saturday, you'd start on Wednesday. So we put it on a low loader and brought it up at full speed, which was absolutely sensational. So that was cart marking.
Yeah.
And it was a glorious day, unlike the previous year, which was the wettest cart marking in 500 years. So absolutely sensational.
So we should
day.
Definitely be inviting you to that next year then.
Yes.
If you can wander along with something in here, and you know.
I was going to say, I don't want.
We could parachute in one of those bikes in a.
Bring a Spitfire or something.
But yeah, get a Spitfire under the arch. Might be a bit tricky.
Yeah.
Although, of course, when we're talking about Spitfires flying under low things, we have to
There's only one name to mention.
It's Ray Hanna in the Spitfire in, what was it called?
Did it in a piece of cake.
Piece of cake.
Yeah.
Which is, again, we'll put a link to where
he flew. The only time he was caught doing it.
Yeah. He flew a Spitfire underneath somewhere on the Tyne or Tees, wasn't
it? Yes.
Very low bridge. And there's a little memorial to him on the bridge, apparently, because from his daughter he'd put there.
Yes, that's right.
But also there's lots of other low-flying Spitfires, at which point we're contractually obliged to mention Alan de Cadenet, who was a Le Mans racer and father of, Amanda de Cadenet, was a TV thing. But he was very much a man of mechanical interests, and he did a piece to camera, which again we'll put the YouTube link to, but please don't watch it, it's not suitable for work. Because when a Spitfire flies over his head, he does say some very choice words. And that was again Ray Hanna, who went on, who was the founding leader of the Red Arrows.
Here at Biggin Hill, 1965.
There you go.
Yeah.
And his son was also a pilot, I believe, he was sadly killed in a...
Yeah, Mark Hanna flew, as well as their collection.
Yeah.
He flew Phantoms in the area.
Didn't he also fly in Bond films? I'm going to say one of the Pierce Brosnan ones. If only Steve Gooding was here, he'd tell us.
He would tell us because he'd have his book.
Anyway, so Mark Hanna, I think, was the pilot of an Albatross or something like that in one of the Bond films.
Quite probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, they did a lot of film work.
Exactly.
Old Flying Machine Company.
That's it. What a fantastic name. Old Flying Machine Company.
Indeed.
So it does exactly what it says on the album.
Yeah, yeah. What a pair of those
two. So you're saying you're off to a little air show next week?
Yeah, next Saturday. I haven't been to an air show for so long because being immersed in all this, you're pretty much at an air show.
Yes.
And all the stuff's here.
Yeah.
I'm going to the Shuttleworth Collection on Saturday. They've got a summer air show. I think there's like a 10 or so Spitfires flying and a MiG-17, and then the Shuttleworth Collection's own aeroplanes.
Okay.
Should be a
couple. So how many airworthy Spitfires are there?
Well...
Is that like saying Helen's piece of string?
That can change by the day, because the minute, like you saw our Spirit of Kent Spitfire up there, that's being serviced, so technically it's not airworthy.
Yeah, okay.
So, you know, these days there tends to be about 70-odd.
Wow.
Globally.
Flyable.
That's still a big number, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, because every time you see it in the press, it goes, there's only 50 left flying, it's growing, because we're here doing this. We've added sort of 15 or so onto what used to be the total.
Yeah.
It's probably about 250 known identities of Spitfires in various conditions.
Of the, I'm going to say, 11,000 that were built? Is it
22?
22,000.
22 and a bit thousand, I believe. Yeah. And then, so it's not a bad survival
1%,
rate.
But bearing in mind that they had such a short life expectancy because they were in combat.
Yeah.
3 weeks was a good innings.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And the pilots in the Battle of Britain, not much longer than that. Sometimes.
I think if you lasted 3 weeks, you'd be the CO by then.
Yeah. Well, as we saw in the film The Battle of Britain.
Your turn.
Simon comes in and is told off in the start and is the commander by the end.
Extraordinary.
Telling people off for doing victory rolls over my aeroplane.
Strawberry jam.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of good actors that went on to big things.
Oh, what a cast that film had.
Absolutely.
You've got... wasn't it Robert Grant in it? Robert Grant. The guy who's in Jaws.
Robert Shaw,
thank you. He was also in, of course, the Bond film, and actually a bit part, I believe, in the Dambusters, which we might have to do a future one on. And Ian McShane, obviously, who went to bigger things.
Yeah.
Susanna York, I seem to remember her for some reason.
And Kenneth Moore, otherwise it wouldn't have been a war film.
No.
Exactly. No.
Is he very badly burned? Christopher Plummer playing a Canadian, and when I had it, she had the word Canada on his jacket to do it properly.
He was only missing Donald Pleasance, really, wasn't he?
Well, yeah. Michael Caine was in it, but I can't remember. He just played a
Canfield. Yeah, he was. I think they were meant to be down at Red Hill or somewhere like that.
Yeah.
We perhaps ought to talk to one or two things for the rest of our audience.
Yes.
And so I've got a couple of things from last time. We were talking about The Man Who Haunted Himself. Do you remember?
Which was Roger Moore film.
The film that Roger Moore did in order to try and not be typecast.
Rover P4.
Indeed so. Somebody pointed out, of course, that Roger Moore's wife in that was Hildegard Neal. And she, of course, is married to Brian Blessed.
Oh, really?
Not only is she married to Brian Blessed, but I am going to Brian Blessed's 90th birthday shout, which is a one-night performance at a theatre in London.
Wow.
So Brian Blessed, it's in September, he's doing a 90th birthday appearance in the theatre, which I'm going to in September. I wonder if his voice is loud at 90. As it was.
Of course it is.
The rest of his life. So I'm seriously looking forward to that. And those wonderful lines like, Gordon's alive. From Flash Gordon.
Yes. Oh, God, yeah.
And he had this most amazing singing voice, because in Metropolis, he was the lead male in Metropolis. And it was a really taxing vocal for him to do. So he was incredible. And then he climbed mountains.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was in Blackadder as the king in the first
Yes, indeed.
I'd love to show him around this place.
I bet.
Imagine the voice echoing around these.
Oh, just extraordinary.
How many Spitfires? Dagger, dagger, dagger.
He's very much into swearing, though. He's a real passionate swearer. So if you do get him on,
yes,
that would be fun, wouldn't it?
Coach him first.
So he's looking for your surprised face.
Yes.
We were talking in a previous episode about Randall and Hopkirk deceased.
Yes.
Which you of course remember was Kenneth Cope, who was Minnie Caldwell's nephew in Coronation Street, and Kenneth Cope and Mike Pratt.
That's right.
Mike Pratt died really young. He died when he was 45. But Mike Pratt has one claim to fame that nobody has ever remembered, which is that not only was he an actor, he was also a singer and a writer.
Right.
And with Lionel Bart, he co-wrote Little White Ball by Tommy Steele.
No way.
Yes.
God.
Isn't that extraordinary? When you see him in Randall and Hopkirk deceased, because he looks like a bit of a, you know, right? You can't imagine that he would write a comedy song like Little White Ball.
No.
For Tommy Steele, of all people.
There's another brilliant claim to fame.
Go on.
That you could say he has or he created. Do you know what his son does?
No.
Guy Pratt.
No.
Plays bass with Pink Floyd and has done for about 30 years.
Really?
No.
One of the world's best bass guitar players.
Do you know how I was getting confused when you said composer? I thought you could say Mike Batt, who did the Wombles.
Indeed.
That's someone else.
Indeed. Well, of course, as you know, I've met Mike Batt. Because,
in Uncle
course,
Bulgaria, in, yes.
You know that already. That was extraordinary. So, Mike Pratt. Now, guess who I met a week before last? I met Sir Richard Stilgo.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Cool.
Sir Richard Stilgo was the after-dinner speaker at the Worshipful Company of Waterman and Lighterman. And the master this year is my good friend Sean Collins, who is the chief executive of Thames Clippers, where I happen to be a director.
Yes.
And I've been prevailing on Sean to introduce me to his friend, Richard Stilgo. And not only did he introduce me to him, he invited me to the dinner where he was going to speak.
Oh, fantastic.
So the great thing about Richard Stilgo, he's as funny as ever. And he said, you're Sean's other friend. Which is a typical Richard Stilgo comment, bearing in mind that he wrote Starlight Express, some of the stuff for Phantom and all the rest of it. And so saw Richard, which was tremendous. He's as funny now in his early 80s as he ever was. Of course, he didn't do an afternoon speech. He had a keyboard and sang. He brought somebody with him because he sponsors a school that helps disabled people and people with mental difficulties to make music.
Yes.
Orpheus.
Yes, which is right by Godston. It's around the back of the Regional Operations Centre of National Highways.
So he brought one of these people along to sing with him, and he just stood up in front of this audience unprompted and said, you might remember me. I was a satirist. I used to do some
Nationwide.
Various things. Things have been a bit quiet since the Jeremy Corbyn lookalike work all dried up.
Yeah.
Great.
And so, Robin Cook. He could have been a good Robin Cook.
He could have been a very good Robin Cook. He could have been indeed. So that was my enjoyment in the last couple of weeks or so. He was a hero of mine. He was on my bucket list, although he said that was a bit rude since he's in his early 80s. You know.
Yeah.
So that was good. And what else have we had? We've had one or two people write in.
Including somebody
who explained to me that when John Barry did the music for On Her Majesty's Secret Service, which is the George Lazenby Bond,
yes,
he deliberately overplayed it and deliberately made the music even more hyper Bond,
yeah,
Goldfinger and From Russia with Love and so on. because he was trying to compensate for the fact that Sean Connery
wasn't there. Yeah.
He wanted to make it sound more Bond than Bond. Mm. Anyway, so thank you very much for writing in and telling us about that. Who else have you
We've had a request that we should do a Dam Busters episode.
That we should
saying
do.
That we've just focused on Battle of Britain and Spitfires.
Yeah.
If only there was somewhere we could go that had some Barnes Wallace memorabilia.
Yes, I wonder.
Inside the M25.
Inside the M25 with a co-located bus museum.
If only his office still existed.
It does in yeah. And some of you might have seen the thing I posted, but I was walking through Effingham of all places to get my car service, and went to try and find a coffee shop, and the coffee shop was shut, but they, people of Effingham had put a little information board about what went on in Effingham,
right.
And in the churchyard it said Barnes Wallace's grave, so I thought I'll go and just pay my respects, so yeah. I did, and I managed to not hum the tune of the Dam Busters until I was out of earshot of the graveyard.
Has it got like a little dam on it?
No, it was just particularly very, very, very.
Just a trick
there. Yeah, could have done. No, it was quite. What's the word I want? Quite poignant. Really, because you never got to meet the bloke, but just tipped my cap while I was there. It was a lovely summer's day. But the big, most exciting thing recently been this cart market. I can't get over how exciting it was.
You enjoyed that, didn't you?
You think you're going to see a branding of a cart, and you do. Blooming great big Royal Logistics Corps tank transporter comes in, a 60-ton Kenworth recovery truck.
Indeed. And by the way, the Corporation of London takes a bit of persuading on this, because underneath the Guildhall Yard are the Roman remains.
Oh,
the last thing you want is the Guildhall Yard
going whoosh. Yes, they also had a really interesting piece of kit which was used in Croydon for cleaning the tram lanes.
Oh yes, wasn't that interesting? Look, I used to be responsible for the trams in Croydon. I never knew that there was a special machine for cleaning out
tram
and
this tracks. Special machine is called the Traminator.
Nice.
And it's got a picture of Arnold Schwarzenegger on the side. The Traminator.
Invite him to Croydon.
Exactly. Well, apparently it's used for picking up things like dead bits of chicken bone and things that otherwise would get in the railway.
Yeah.
And I thought, who knew these things existed? But also, I was very impressed by the fact we can now have a pizza, Domino's pizza truck.
Delivered electrically, yeah.
Delivered electrically. And somebody said, how many pizzas were in the truck? Well, it's a 12-ton truck load, and if it's, say, a 250-gram pizza, you can do the maths. But I was trying to work out whether it would run out of space or size. At this point, I thought, you really are a sad so-and-so,
you
Graham. But that it was quite a piece of impressive piece of kit, because it was refrigerated.
It was.
And electric.
It
and
was really
had
good.
300-mile range, and I thought, we're getting there.
There's one other death that we didn't talk about.
Oh, yeah?
Radio 4 on long wave.
Oh, my word. Yes. Droitwich.
Droitwich transmitter switched off. End of radio 4 long wave.
Yes, they did the shipping forecast and then turned it off. Which apparently, if you're a nuclear submarine captain, that was a way that you knew that Britain was still going, was to tune to radio 4 long wave in the morning and see if the shipping forecast or Farming Today came on. Mm. Of course, that's gone.
That's
now.
Gone. Wow.
And also, for those of us who used to drive across the continent and want to know the news. Having long wave that went miles was a good thing. They'll be turning off medium wave soon.
That'd be shocking. And I've got a pub quiz one for you.
Oh yeah.
How many News at 10 newscasters have there been in the history of the programme?
How many News at 10?
News at 10. So ITV News at 10, the 30-minute 10 o'clock.
Yeah. Oh God.
Anyway, errors and omissions accepted.
So you've got. Did it start with Robin Day and people like that?
No.
Sandy Gall. Reginald Bosanquet.
Now that here's the problem. You see, I have got the list. If you want me to make this into
Anna
a
Ford.
Quiz, I can quickly.
Trevor
take
McDonough.
This. Oh, hang on a second. You have to do it
slower
than that.
Trevor McDonough. Trevor McDonough. News at 10.
Indeed.
Is it still on now? Is it still going? Well,
news
I don't
at
watch
10.
TV anymore.
No, I don't think anybody.
Well, maybe 10 then.
Well, tell us the answer.
Well, so 39 is the number.
39
is the number. Yeah. Errors and omissions, except as I said, not forgetting Gordon Honeycomb.
Oh, yeah.
As you say, Reginald Bosanquet.
Reggie Bosanquet.
Indeed.
Where did you go?
Alistair with? Burnett.
Sir, wasn't he Sir Alistair?
I think
Burnett,
he was. Yeah. I think he was. He was.
Selina Scott. What
John Suchet.
Well, his brother, of course, went on to do other things, didn't he?
David Suchet. Yeah.
Yeah.
David Suchet nearly bought the flat next to me.
Really?
Yeah, he came round the place next door for. He saw who the neighbours were and didn't
did he
proceed.
Sort of put his Poirot type face on and go? Yes.
It was. So those were some things that came across. I had some other things to talk about. We probably don't have the time.
We're
knocking on to an hour here.
No, indeed. Well, we should go and look at some Spitfires from the external position.
So we should say something else, Andy, shouldn't we? Which is last time, because we happened to be in a visually attractive place, which was the Dad's Army Museum at Thetford, we also put our audio track onto YouTube and sprinkled in, firstly, a little teaser that you and I did. Don't tell him, Pike. We did that. And then, in order to make it visually more appealing, we put some other material on, and overwhelmingly people liked it. So something like four times as many people who listened to the audio on their podcast channel,
yeah.
Four times as many people watched it on YouTube,
yeah.
Although it's entirely possible they listened to it on YouTube, and so on. So since we're in another visually beautiful place, we're going to do this again. So everybody's listening. I'm not sure we can guarantee to do video and audio every episode.
No.
Because the video takes a lot longer to do than the audio
does.
But
we are something where there is something to see,
where
like,
there is
say,
something.
A Spitfire or nine,
yes.
Which we shall verify that number as we wander around.
It's more than that.
Down there.
It's probably nine in here.
So we've
got the other hanger there.
So I think what we're saying is we're going to try and do video while we can, but if it's just you and me talking to each other, there's probably no point, because you can look us up on the internet.
Yes.
But if we're in a nice place like this,
indeed,
I think it's a really
indeed.
Good. I think it's
indeed.
A really good thing.
And
to
we're
do,
always
so,
still open to invites for interesting places with visual stuff to go and see.
We will gladly do that.
We, you know, our demographic and audience. If it's before about 1918, we're not really that keen, are we? Is that fair to say? Certainly not 21st century stuff.
No. Maybe for your Dam Busters episode, you could go to East Kirkby where they've got the Lancaster
Just
Jane.
Jane. Should we try and she'll try and invite ourselves there.
Yeah. It fits into all the other locations you've been broadcasting from. So
exactly. Good, yeah. Excellent idea.
Worth giving them a call.
There you go.
What, they can only say no.
Who?
Very good. Very good.
Well, we've got to wrap it up then.
Well, thank you, Paul.
Pleasure.
What a superb place. I mean, the smile
brilliant.
On Leon's face when
absolutely.
He walked in, he was like Christmas.
Indeed.
For us,
hasn't
for
touched one yet.
No, he hasn't
hasn't
dagger.
Broken one yet.
So flyspitfire.com gives you the details of how to book.
Yeah.
There's a small charge to sit in a Spitfire, but then that's not unreasonable given that there's only 250 of them left in the world. And you can kind of just come and smell the air. The air smells of oil, pistons, little bit of fabric, largely aluminium. There's bits of swarf on the floor that
you could take home.
No, the swarf is on the broom because the floor
is
clean.
I do apologise. But what a place. And if anyone ever says, oh, well, we don't make things in the UK anymore, we remake Spitfires.
We do.
And I think, you know, you weren't blowing smoke when you said this is the world centre of excellence for Spitfires.
It's become it, yeah. It's nothing quite like it anywhere else on the planet.
No. So this has been Andy and Leon Missing the Point yet again, episode 6. So thank you very much to Leon for laying on all the technology and all the editing, as you always do. And thank you very much for Paul Campbell from the Biggin Hill Heritage Hangar for showing us around. What a fabulous afternoon we've had. And if you come here, you will not go away without a smile on your face. And you will see some stuff that you really didn't know. Sitting in a blue hangar and right on the edge of Biggin Hill Aerodrome.
Magic.
Thank you very much indeed.
Brilliant. Let's go.
Yeah.
Play with some toys.
Rabbit ears on the television set. Tuning in to worlds we haven't met. Andy and Leon missing the point again. Laughing through the static time and time. Through the
underneath that old cathode sun.
Tuning forks in the cosmic air.